A very good evening and welcome to all of you to Theodore House, to the home of the Christian Heritage Centre. It's wonderful to welcome you all here once again. I know many of you have been here before for various events. Some of you, it's your first time. A very warm welcome to all of you. If you had been here some 8 years ago in this very spot, you would have had the open sky and the fresh Lancashire air above you, and you would have had to climb over quite a bit of rubble and timber to get to where you are sat or standing right now. The fact that we are sitting in this beautiful building is, first of all, by the grace of God's providence and to his glory. But in this case, God's providence chose to work particularly with the person of Lord David Alton of Liverpool, who founded the Christian Heritage Centre charity and who indomitably drove the project forward with the faithful support of John Cowdell, God rest his soul, and of their fellow trustees. Lord Alton saw here the potential for a place to nourish and nurture the religious conscience, the religious will and spirit of Catholics and Christians in England and indeed beyond. Why in this particular place? Because we are located in a setting and in the proximity of relics and artifacts that speak with great force of the great love story of God for man, that is the fullness of the Catholic faith. Here in this place, we have a powerful witness to the men and women who were so convinced by Christ that they were ready to shed their blood for him. They were unwilling to bend before usurpers, before human usurpers of the divine law. Such pretense at absolute authority over the human soul and indeed body should have no place in our Western culture, which is built on the basic premise that every person is uniquely made in the image of God and made for God himself. And all the more so when that culture has reached a quasi-unanimous consensus in the remarkable document, the UN Declaration of Human Rights in 1948, which is so rooted in Catholic principles through its Catholic authors. Yet, time and again, God is rejected, and as a result, those who speak of him are so too. We go back to 2,000 years ago to the greatest prophet before Christ, John the Baptist, who was beheaded because he spoke of God's law before his sovereign. So too, Saints Thomas More and John Fisher. Countless other people today still are equally persecuted for their faith in Christ. Here in the UK, not so much, but nonetheless, people like Isabel Hannah von Spruce and Father Sean were arrested, and just a couple of days ago, Adam Smith Connor was fined £9,000 for praying in his head outside an abortion clinic. This is what happens when the Holy Trinity is removed from the public vision, leaving the place of ultimate authority to the human individual to supply. As per the task that Lord Alton charged it with, the Christian Heritage Centre aspires to help to reform tomorrow's society as a Christian one, to offer a coherent alternative to the nihilistic vision that dominates our culture at present. In particular, we seek to offer a holistic formation for the young people today who seek to lead tomorrow's generation. We seek to support the building blocks of both civil and ecclesial society by supporting and preparing young people for marriage and by supporting our priests. And to those of us, all of us here present, to whom it is given to have freely received and accepted Jesus Christ as our Saviour, it is up to us to ensure that others have the freedom and the opportunity to do the same. And so tonight we're gathered to hear about St. Thomas More and religious liberty, and I now invite Lord David Alton to introduce this evening's speaker. Thank you, David.
Thank Thank you very much, Stefan. Buildings, and especially those that rise from the rubble, as Theodore House did, are important. But the people who run those buildings are even more important. And I think we have been extraordinarily blessed by having Stefan Kaminski here as our director, but also the trustees, people like Anton DePiro, who's sitting here on the front row, and others of you who are in the room, who've played a hugely important part in making this such a successful venture. And I hope if you enjoy this evening, and if you feel stimulated and inspired by it, that you'll encourage others to come and participate. Just a few months ago, in memory of Phyllis Bowman, whose portrait is over here, the founder of the Society for Protection of Unborn Children and of Right to Life, we had a sponsored walk along the Tolkien Trail. Why? Because Tolkien, who wrote Lord of the Rings, came here often when one of his sons trained to be a priest and another was on the staff of the college. We've tried always to honour the memory of people like Phyllis Bowman, but also our belief that every human being is made in God's image, and therefore from the womb to the tomb, they should enjoy all of the rights that the human being is entitled to. Those inalienable rights are a gift of God, but it's up to people like us to defend them. Every day that I'm in Parliament, yesterday was no exception, I walk through Westminster Hall. I visited it first when I was a schoolboy at a school named for Edmund Campion, to walk past the coffin of the greatest of our prime ministers, Winston Churchill. It was in that hall in July 1535 that the former Speaker of the House of Commons and former Lord Chancellor was tried for high treason for denying the validity of the Act of Succession. And of course, also in that hall, Edmund Campion and many others would follow him. St. Thomas's judges included the new Lord Chancellor, Sir Thomas Audley, along with Anne Boleyn's father, brother, and uncle. The odds were stacked to make an acquittal an impossibility. Kangaroo courts and Star Chambers were the mark of a despotic and corrupted system of government, which betrayed the spirit of Magna Carta, the Royal Charter, that in 1215 established the principle that the king and his government are not above the law. The Great Charter, of course, had been signed by King John at Runnymede. Now, although we can speak with some pride of our contemporary rule of law, it is important to recognise the fragility of some of the freedoms which it sets out to protect, and even the right, as we've just heard from Stefan, to private prayer or to wear a crucifix. In our own domestic courts, those rights have been challenged. We can also see its debasement in eugenic laws that permit the taking of life up to and even during birth on a baby with a disability, and now a proposed new law, which received its first reading in the House of Commons this week, to permit euthanasia. Even all of this should be seen in the perspective of the infamies committed, though, under what passes for law in so many other jurisdictions. All over the world today, innocent people are arraigned before bogus courts devoid of justice, and like Thomas More, sometimes it even leads to their execution too. Think of Iran, where more than 255 executions have taken place since July of this year, when the regime's new president took office. At the beginning of this month, the Mullah's regime executed 30 prisoners, this month, October 2024, not 400 years ago, and those included three women. Or think of Pakistan and a Christian woman sentenced to death for alleged blasphemy. Or think of North Korea, where a court sentenced a 22-year-old young man and executed him for listening to and sharing K-pop music and watching South Korean movies. Or with the Foreign Secretary in China today, recall the 1,000 pro-democracy prisoners incarcerated in Hong Kong jails with 76-year-old United Kingdom citizen and Catholic Jimmy Lai in solitary confinement and denied even the sacraments, and unless released, his ample fourth educated son Sebastian told me last week his father will undoubtedly die there. Or think of Zhang Zheng, the young Christian lawyer and citizen journalist who went to Wuhan to examine reports about origins of COVID. She was jailed by a Chinese Communist Party court for 4 years, and her lawyers have been denied contact with her since. Think too of the vast number of persecuted people who experience gross violations of Article 18 referred to by Stefan of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the article which says everybody, each one of us, has the right to believe, the right not to believe, and the right to change our belief. That is breached all over the world in so many jurisdictions today. There are 61 countries throughout the world with combined populations of over 4.9 billion people, with Christians, incidentally, by a country mile, the biggest faith group experiencing persecution and experiencing everything from genocide and atrocity crimes, sexual violence, abduction, forced marriages and conversion, displacement, destruction of properties, discrimination in schools and the workplace, physical and mental torture. That is why Article 18 is so important, but why it's so worthless in so many places. Yet UK legislators don't even mention religious liberty or the persecution of these minorities, from Uyghur Muslims to Nigerian Christians, Yazidis to Baha'is or Tibetan Buddhists, and many others. They don't even mention them in our own government's 10-year strategy for international development. All those who suffer for their faith may at least draw consolation and perhaps some strength from the words of Thomas More, who said this: "Here, bring your wounded hearts. Here, tell your anguish. Earth has no sorrow that heaven cannot heal." And as this evening, we consider the role of the rule of law today, both in domestic and the international context, and some of those suffering with such grief. We need the patron saint of lawyers and legislators to guide and inspire us, which brings us to tonight's lecturer. Dr. Marcus Cole is the Joseph A. Matson Dean and Professor of Law at Notre Dame Law School. He was appointed by University President, the Reverend John Jenkins CSC, and began his term on July the 1st, 2019. He is the 11th Dean in the history of Notre Dame. Dean Cole is a leading scholar of the empirical law and economics of commerce and finance. He was a faculty member at Stanford Law School from 1997 until he came to Notre Dame. And before that, he was an associate with the Chicago law firm of Mayer Brown. He clerked for Judge Maurice Shepard Arnold of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit. Dean Cole's extensive legal and scholarly background includes serving as a national fellow at the Hoover Institution, a fellow of the University of the Amsterdam Center for Law and Economics, and a visiting professor at several institutions around the world, including the University of Amsterdam, the University of Vienna, Leiden University, the Northwestern University, Korea University, and Peking University School of Transnational Law in Shenzhen in China. He served on the boards of several civic, academic, and charitable organizations, including those of the Central Pacific region of the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith. He's the former president of the board of directors of Rocketship Education, a national non-profit charter school network operating California's most successful charter school for low-income children. And he's also served on the board of the trustees of Bellarmine College Preparatory, which incidentally, given the claims that Stonyhurst College makes about being the oldest Jesuit school in the world, well, the oldest Jesuit secondary school on the West Coast is Bellarmine College Preparatory. Dean Cole earned his bachelor's degree in applied economics from Cornell University and his Juris Doctor from Northwestern University, where he served as editor-in-chief of the Northwestern Journal of International Law and Business. It was Dean Cole who created the Religious Liberty Initiative within his law school, and in which I have a privilege of serving as an advisory board member. His championing of religious freedom in an academic setting and through the formation of tomorrow's lawyers is an outstanding and hugely important initiative. It fits like a glove with the ethos and the inspiration behind this Christian Heritage Center at Theodore House, and it fits like a glove with the tradition headed up in this country, at the top of which stands St. Thomas More, of Catholic lay involvement in both the law and in political life. So it's my great pleasure to ask Dr. Cole to address us, and please welcome him.
Thank you so much, Lord Alton. I'm so honored, deeply honored to be here. This is a very special visit for me, as Notre Dame to me is the preeminent Catholic institution in the United States. It's important for us to connect with other Catholic institutions around the world. And so I'm deeply honored, and my wife and I are grateful for the invitation to be here, especially to talk about one of my personal heroes and models. God gave us saints to model our lives after, and Thomas More, to me, is the most important saint in my life. What I have to say tonight about St. Thomas More actually might be quite controversial. In order for you to understand my perspective on St. Thomas More, I need to tell you a story about another but modern-day hero of mine, the person my wife and I, Angie, and I bought our house from. His name is Father David Link. Now, Father Link was the dean of Notre Dame Law School for 24 years, so he was one of my predecessors. I'm the 11th dean of the University of Notre Dame's Law School. He was the 8th dean of the Notre Dame Law School, and he was there. He was a fixture. He was there for 24 years. But he was a husband, a father to 6 children, and his wife got ill and suffered from cancer, and so he stepped down as dean of Notre Dame Law School and took care of her. And when she passed in 2002, he looked for the next thing to do in his life. And so he was persuaded by Father Theodore Hesburgh, the longtime president of the University of Notre Dame, that what he really should do is become a priest. And so this man who had been a husband and father of 6 children decided to go to seminary at the age of 62 and become a priest. And he became a priest and then spent the last 11 years of his life serving in the 7 prisons of northern Indiana, just going and living Matthew 25, visiting prisoners in prison as Jesus had commanded. But one of the things he did before he passed away, just almost exactly 3 years ago, he wanted us, as we were new to Indiana, he wanted us to look at his house. He hadn't lived in his house for 10 years, and he wanted to sell it. And he had considered passing his house down to his children, but they weren't really that interested in it. So he thought that the right thing to do was to sell it and then divide the proceeds among his 6 children. So my wife Angie and I went to look at the house, and we fell in love with it. It's beautiful. It's on a stream. It's on 7 acres, and has lots of wildlife, and it was magnificent. But then we asked him the price of the house, and he responded with a price that we thought was ridiculous. And in fact, I said to him, "That's a ridiculous amount of money." And he said, "You're selling a house in California. You can afford it." And so I remember having Christmas dinner with the president of the University of Notre Dame, who asked me, "Have you found a place to live yet?" And I said, "Well, you know, we've met Father Dave Link, and we've been talking to him about buying his home, and he's gouging us. He's just literally gouging us." I said, "Aren't you priests?" His Father John Jenkins, the president, was a priest. I said, "Aren't you priests supposed to take a vow of poverty?" And Father Jenkins said to me something I'll never forget. He said, "Yes, but remember, he was a lawyer first." And that's essentially what I have to say about St. Thomas More, is that yes, he was a saint, but he was a lawyer first. And what I want to present to you is a paradox about the life of St. Thomas More, the life and death of St. Thomas More, with regard to religious freedom. And in fact, what I want to suggest is that although we hold St. Thomas More dear in our hearts, and we hold him as a martyr to Christ, we have to think twice about whether we hold him as a martyr to religious freedom. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about St. Thomas More, not as a saint, but as a lawyer, because I think understanding him as a lawyer will help us understand his relationship to religious freedom. So let me talk a little bit about St. Thomas More, not as a saint, but as a lawyer. And the things that I want to emphasize about St. Thomas More was that he was a man of very deep convictions and principles. And again, as I said, he's my hero. He's one of the reasons why I became a lawyer, the very first lawyer in my family. But he has an interesting life, and I think we can learn a lot about religious freedom from his life. He was born to a fairly well-established family, and was educated at Oxford, St. Mary's Hall, or Canterbury Hall. He started, at the insistence of his father, in the Inns of Chancery to become a solicitor, but became and he started in New Inn, which was a solicitor's inn for lawyers associated with Middle Temple, but became so interested in the other aspects of law, with the work that barristers did, that he decided to move to Lincoln's Inn, and he was called to the bar in 1502. And he became very close intellectual and personal friends with Erasmus of Rotterdam. And in fact, Erasmus arranged the publication of his most important work, Utopia. And that work was published in 1516, so 16 years before his execution. But it was published in Latin and wasn't translated into English. And again, Erasmus had it translated into English 16 years after his execution. But Erasmus is on record as describing More as a person of piety, a person of character. In fact, More's reputation for piety and for his character was essential to the story that I'm telling tonight. He was also at one time toyed in 1503 and 1504. Toyed with the possibility of joining a monastery, becoming a monk. And in fact, he had lived next to a monastery just outside the walls of London. And then the very next year, instead of becoming a priest, he did the next best thing. He ran for Parliament. And he was elected to Parliament and served in Parliament as a politician. But the other interesting aspect of his life was that he worked for Cardinal Wolsey, and he was essentially his career under Wolsey, Wolsey's chief of staff, I think we would call it today. So he accompanied Wolsey on Wolsey's most important missions. Including a mission to visit the Holy Roman Emperor, Charles V. But the thing that I want you to focus on tonight is his other role. So Wolsey, as the chancellor, was essentially the highest judicial officer in England. And part of that role was to pursue heretics. And in particular, Thomas More took great interest in pursuing anyone who was associated with the Protestant Reformation. When Wolsey fell ill, More succeeded him as chancellor. King Henry VIII appointed him as chancellor, in large part because of their increasing friendship, but also his belief that More was the natural successor to Wolsey. And in that role, Moore did what Woolsey had done. Woolsey had presided over, as chancellor, six executions of Protestants for heresy. And Thomas Moore matched that record. There were six people executed for heresy under Thomas Moore as chancellor. And in fact, there are some historians who would attribute the execution of William Tyndale on the continent to agents of Thomas Moore. So Thomas Moore and Tyndale were fierce enemies and rivals. Tyndale, who is best known for his translation of the New Testament, circulated this controversial New Testament throughout Europe, is essentially a Lutheran or Reformationist New Testament. And Thomas Moore saw it as a deeply biased and heretical translation. And in battling publications, referred to Tyndale as a liar. And Tyndale assaulted in writing King Henry VIII. And King Henry asked Moore to defend his honor, and Moore did so in writing in some of the most colorful language you will ever see written by a saint. But he was reputed for his character and his other virtues, as Robert Whittington, his contemporary, referred to him. He said, "Moore is a man of an angel's wit and singular learning. I know not his fellow. For where is the man of that gentleness, lowliness, and affability? And as time requireth, a man of marvelous mirth and pastimes, and sometime of as sad gravity, a man for all seasons." Now, someone who was not of Thomas More's temperament was his boss, his client, King Henry VIII. And I want us to think of Henry VIII as his client, because essentially the dilemma that I want to present to you, that Thomas More faced, was not necessarily or exclusively a moral dilemma. It was also a legal dilemma, and it was a carefully crafted legal dilemma by Henry VIII and his right-hand man, Cromwell. Henry, at the death of his father, Henry VII, married Catherine, the widow of his older brother, Arthur, and came to regret that decision. And over time, because she couldn't bear him an heir to the throne, he saw a threat to his dynasty. Now, that threat was compounded by the fact that the church saw marriage as insoluble. And so Henry VIII was increasingly interested in the ideas of the Protestant Reformation, not necessarily because he was committed to the Lutheran proposition, but instead he saw it as a practical solution to his concern about succession. Now, in order to accomplish his end, he first had his friend Thomas More appointed chancellor, and by the way, I should say that Thomas More becomes the first lay chancellor of England in succeeding Cardinal Wolsey. But in addition to appointing his friend, Henry VIII carefully constructs a series of legal scaffolds, I will call them, in order to achieve this result. And that scaffold is erected through a series of statutes and events. The oldest of these predates both Henry VIII and Thomas More, and that's the Statute of Praemunire. The Statute of Praemunire essentially grew out of Gallicanism on the continent. So the Gallicanism movement on the continent was a movement by which state authorities felt the ability to appoint religious leaders, either that or to resist the authority of the Pope in Rome. And this played out in France with the dueling popes, but the principle was that state authority should be separate from papal authority, and in the jurisdictions where civil authority existed, papal authority had limited reach. So the Statute of Praemunire essentially says that anyone who undermines the authority of the king is essentially guilty of treason. This wasn't immediately applied to the Pope, but eventually the concept was cleverly applied to clergy in the United Kingdom, or in England, I'm sorry. So the first incident was the indictment of clergy in 1530. Now, there's a long lead up to this, right? There's the king is essentially trying to establish authority over England that is immune from papal authority. And so any clergy that didn't recognize the authority of the king over the authority of the pope was essentially in violation of the Statute of Praemunire. And so the clergy were indicted in 1530 and were put on trial and convicted. Then in January of 1531, the king extends an olive branch to the clergy who were indicted and convicted and says, essentially, if you recognize my authority over that of the Pope, I'll pardon you. And so he has an act of pardon passed by Parliament in 1531, and that is also extended later to the laity who had refused to recognize the authority of the king over the king's subjects versus the Pope. The next event was essentially the submission of the clergy, where the king insists upon that the clergy acknowledge him as their supreme authority in England, and that is solidified by the Convocation of Canterbury, where Henry gives the Archbishop of Canterbury an agreement, a document that he wants the clergy to sign and agree to. And that was done on April 12th of 1532. That was the last straw for Thomas More. The very next day, April 13th of 1532, Thomas More resigns as the king's chancellor. He saw the king's efforts with regard to the clergy as a usurpation of the church's authority in England. The other issue that was boxing Thomas More in was the statute in restraint of appeals. So as chancellor, Thomas More would have been the ultimate judge, the Supreme Court, if you will, of actions in equity that were outside of the law. And acts in equity could override cases in law, and essentially the Court of Chancery was an outgrowth of the competition between the law courts and the ecclesiastical courts. So at one time, if you had an action against another person, you could bring an action in a court of law, but it had to fit what were called the writ system. You had to fill out essentially a form, and you had to articulate a case that met what was called a form of action. And that's where we get the term form of action today. However, if you felt that justice was on your side, that your case couldn't fit the forms of action, you didn't have to go to law. You had an alternative court. You could go to the ecclesiastical courts. And the ecclesiastical courts would hear your case. For example, if someone had promised you something in a contract, an oral contract, for example, and you didn't have a writing that fit the form of action for an action of contract in law, right? You could bring an action in breach of faith in the ecclesiastical courts. Now, ecclesiastical courts overseen by bishops essentially were spiritual courts. So they oversaw actions regarding sin. And if you had made someone a promise and didn't keep that promise, that was a sin. And that gave the ecclesiastical courts jurisdiction, essentially over contracts. The way the king's courts responded to that was to create the courts of chancery. And so the courts of chancery gave litigants an opportunity to argue cases that couldn't be heard in courts of law, and essentially competed with the ecclesiastical courts. But it wasn't enough that the king's friend was the chancellor, the head of the courts of chancery. He still had to protect against appeals going to the ecclesiastical courts. And so the statute in restraint of appeals essentially forbade litigation appeals in the ecclesiastical courts as an alternative avenue to justice. That same year, we have the first act of succession, because what the king wants to do is divorce his wife, marry his new mistress, and ensure that any child born to this new union would, by this act of succession, succeed to his throne. And then the following year, the first act of supremacy was passed, and their parliament is insisting that the king is the supreme law of England, and anyone who is who doesn't recognize that authority is engaged in treason. That's also the purpose of the Treasons Act. The Treasons Act essentially unifies the two previous statutes. It says that anyone who doesn't recognize the articulated heirs to the throne in the first act of succession, or the king's supremacy in the act of supremacy, was guilty of treason. So you all know the story. Thomas More is brought to trial for not swearing to the act of supremacy, and therefore violative of the Treasons Act, largely on what are argued to be trumped up evidence in order to achieve the execution. Now, why does Henry VIII need More executed? Well, that goes to Thomas More's reputation and character more than anything else. The fact of the matter is that he could pass all of these statutes through Parliament, but the people themselves would not believe that Thomas More would do something immoral. And so the king had to oppose Thomas More's position because the people looked to More as a moral example with respect to the king. And so in order to accomplish this, Thomas Cromwell is engaged by Henry VIII essentially to craft this whole legislative plan to cut off the power of the church and to end the marriage to Catherine of Aragon, and to hopefully in the future produce a male heir for the king. Now, in addition to the moral dilemma, Thomas More had a legal dilemma. It was a dilemma that I refer to as a dilemma of legal ethics. He saw the writing on the wall with the Convocation of Canterbury in 1532, and he was horrified by the destruction of centuries-old legal system. And here, what I want to suggest is that Thomas More has a lot more in common with another St. Thomas, St. Thomas Aquinas. Because Thomas More doesn't view English law as a compilation of statutes passed by parliamentarians. No, he sees English law as an embodiment of natural law, the kind of natural law that Thomas Aquinas articulated, and that he felt Parliament expressed through reason and therefore could articulate in statutes. But reason was the higher form of law to Thomas More than parliamentary statutes. In fact, More says this during his trial. He says that if Parliament passes a statute that claims something that is not true, is true, is that law? And More says, no, that is not law. That Parliament can't pass a law that isn't true. And therefore, Parliament can't pass a law that claims that the Pope is not our spiritual authority. It can't pass a law that says God is not God. And so there is a limit to how far the king can go and how far Parliament can go. And so he was horrified by the efforts of Cromwell and the king to erase that connection between English law and natural law. But as the Lord Chancellor, he has a dilemma, a legal dilemma. He either has to adhere to the will of the king, who is his client, or adhere to his ethical and moral duties under ecclesiastical law. And so this is the Treasons Act. It made it high treason to maliciously wish, will, or desire by words or writing, or by craft, imagine, invent, practice, or attempt any bodily harm to be done or committed to the king's most royal person, the queen's, or the heir's apparent, or to deprive them of any of their dignity, title, or name of their royal estates, or slanderously and maliciously publish and pronounce by express writing or words that the king should be heretic, schismatic, tyrant, infidel, or usurper of the crown. So we all know the trial of St. Thomas More, that he's accused of violating the Treasons Act. And during his trial, More argued, "By all which I know, I would not transgress any law or become guilty of any treasonable crime, for this statute nor no other law in the world can punish any man for his silence, seeing they can do no more than punish words or deeds. And my silence is no sign of any malice in my heart, which the king himself must own by my conduct upon divers occasions. Neither does it convince any man of the breach of the law, for it is a maxim among civilians and canonists, qui tacit conscientiae videtur, he that holds his peace seems to give his consent." So in other words, he's arguing that because I'm silent, the most that you can infer from my silence is that I actually consent to the law. But I don't want you to think me any less honoring St. Thomas More when I say that his life presents us with an important paradox that we have to think about with regard to religious freedom. We think of St. Thomas More as a martyr of conscience and a defiant defender of religious liberty. But if you look at Thomas More not as a saint, but as a lawyer, his life is more complicated because he used the authority of the state to prosecute Protestants. In other words, he was the arm of the state's intolerance with regard to religious freedom. So, how do we reconcile this? How could a martyr for religious freedom participate and enforce a legal regime of religious conformity the way Thomas More did? And I want to suggest that we are asking too much of Thomas More when we ask of him to be a martyr to religious liberty and religious freedom. We're asking too much of him. In other words, we need to think of St. Thomas More, who, remember, wasn't canonized until 1935. We need to think of St. Thomas More as a true saint. And what is a true saint? A true saint is a normal person who has strengths and weaknesses, who has flaws, and has contradictions and paradoxes. But God holds them up to us as examples to live our lives by, that we can be redeemed in the way that Thomas More was redeemed. And I think the answer to the paradox of St. Thomas More is that his martyrdom was not a testament to his commitment to religious freedom. To think so is to impose 21st century values on a 16th century figure. I think his martyrdom was instead a testament to his commitment to Christ, as understood by him, and represent and how the church represented Christ's authority on earth as the one true church. Historians and the playwright Robert Bolt suggest that Richard Rich, the Solicitor General for England and Wales, perjured himself in order to support the conviction of Thomas More for treason. I say, regardless of whether this is true, his dilemma was more than a religious, spiritual, or moral one, that even if he did not have to make a choice between the church and the king, he would still have to have made the choice between the law and his client, what he believed the law to be, and his client, the king. So he had a dilemma whether or not it was a moral one. He had a legal one. And in the end, Thomas More chose the law. But even more importantly to me, he chose God. So, his last words, "I die the king's good servant, but God's first." Thank you.